Okay, so, forget this, eh? So let me write down the correct statement. And that's where the proviso comes in, and I was getting ahead of myself, and I knew there was a proviso, and then suddenly I thought, well, nay, it's not needed, but it is needed. So equalizers equal fiber product provided the product of any two objects exists. So this is the correct statement, somewhat lax, but here's what it means. So assume we are given an equalizer. Yes. Well, I mean it in the sense that any equalizer can be written as a fiber product and vice versa. And I'm going to show you how. Namely, so how do we translate it? The point is this. You simply take X cross Y, and you take the map here, which is the identity on X and F on from X to Y. And here you take the identity on X and G on Y. And so let's look at this in the category of sets. So what is the fiber product? It will be the set of all pairs X comma X prime, such that we have the image here, in other words, X comma F of X equals X prime comma G of X prime. So this will be the set. But you see, what this means is, this means that X equals X prime, and then F of X equals G of X. So this is the same thing, it's a bijection with the set of all X, such that F of X equals G of X, and this is equal to the equalizer of F and G. Yes? And this element, this proof in terms of elements, immediately translates into a categorical proof by just using the functors. Namely, we simply look, what does it mean? What is HOM over any category from some object Z into this fiber product? Well, let's just spell it out. It is a set of all morphisms F from Z to X. No, not F, because F we already built into the structure. So let's say A from Z to X and B from Z to X, such that the identity on X comma F applied to, so well, let's draw the diagram. So here we have X cross X over X cross Y, the two projections. No, maybe it's the second one and the first one. Here we had F. Here we had, sorry, here we had, no, 2 and 1. We had the identity on X and G. Here we have the identity on X and F. And so if we are given what is a morphism from here to here, that's the same thing as all the pairs A, B from Z to X, such that the outer diagram commutes. So in other words, the identity on X and F applied to A equals the identity on X and G applied to B. Well, what does that mean? What is this pair? This is simply the morphism. So this is equivalent to saying that A, FA equals B, GB. But of course, this is the same thing as a set of all morphisms C from Z to X, such that FC equals GC. In other words, this is the same thing as the homomorphisms from C from Z into the equalizer of FGY. So that's one direction. And the other direction So now let's assume we start with a fiber product. And I want to write this fiber product as an equalizer. How should I do that? So this is the pullback or Cartesian diagram or fiber product, and I want to realize this as an equalizer. How do I do this? Well, again, let's look at set theory. Set theoretically, what we are doing here, this thing, X cross Z over Y, is going to be the set of all points X comma Y set in X cross Y such that F of X equals G of Y. So how can I write this as an equalizer? Well, clearly, because it should be an equalizer from X cross Y to somewhere. Right, because it's a subset of X cross Y, so how can I view it as an equalizer from two morphisms on X cross Y? Yeah, so where should I end up here? Okay, let's try that. So what should be the map? So let's see. So what would the equalizer be? This would be the set of all X comma Y in X cross Y such that F composed with a projection on X comma Y equals G composed with a second projection on X comma Y. So let's just evaluate the two sides. So what's the left-hand side? Well, I project onto the first coordinate, which is X, and then I apply F. So that's F of X. What do I get here? Well, of course, I project onto Y and take G, so that's G of Y. So in other words, exactly, it means it is a set of all pairs XY such that f of x equals g of y, and that's what I wanted. Sorry, yeah, here, yeah, no, sorry. And again, you can translate this immediately into a categorical proof by replacing elements by morphisms, as we did here. That's the one thing which is good about dealing with presheaves. Often, especially for limits, you just look at the situation for sets and then rewrite it in terms of presheaves. The consequence of this is the following theorem, if you like, theorem and definition. A category C is closed under all finite limits, and so and the definition is if every, of course, set indexed limit exists in C, that's a definition. If and only if all products exist in C, and B, all pullbacks of pairs of morphisms. Just to make sure we didn't define any others, but just to make sure we understand what we're talking about. Exist if and only if A as before and B prime all equalizers exist. And again, of pairs of morphisms. And so I put finite in brackets, and of course you have to insert, if you want the finite piece, so as before. Now the pullbacks and the equalizers only involve a finite set of data, so that doesn't matter. But for the product, there's a distinction, as we saw, say, for the category of finite groups. Finite products exist, but not all products exist in that category. And so closed under all limits is also called sometimes complete. One says the category C is complete if every limit exists. And there is no such thing as finite complete for whatever reason. So complete categories well, what do we have? For example, we saw the category of sets. We convinced ourselves that all products and fiber products exist. Similarly, the category of groups, is complete. So is a category of abelian groups, rings, and lots more. Lie algebras. There is sort of a highfalutin version of this sequence of examples, and it says that any algebraic category is complete. The theorem by Lavier from the early 70s. Now, I don't want to define what an algebraic category is, but it is basically something which has an underlying category of sets and where the structure is defined by some kind, by some commutative diagrams, like expressing associativity for the multiplication on a group, expressing the existence of an inverse, and so on. So these categories are complete, but mind you, how about the category of fields? Is the category of fields complete? So clearly, I mean, the category of fields, the objects are just all the fields, commutative fields, the homomorphisms are homomorphisms of fields. Is it complete? Well, it's a product of two fields of fields. Certainly, I mean, if you assume that the product would be given by the product of the underlying sets, then it's not, right? Because a product of two fields is not a field. It has too many idempotents. So, product of two fields is not a field in general. So, in other words, in the category of fields, the product of two objects does not necessarily exist. Which is annoying, right? So what do you get if you want sort of the smallest category which contains all fields and is closed at least under finite constructions, finite products and fullbacks? Least finite product. No, because fields are special kinds of rings. So you have two operations. You have addition and multiplication, plus a bunch of actions. Right? So you need to enlarge to category to the category what's called of well semi-simple or separable algebra. Now this is not a very precise statement, but you might remember Wedderburn's structure theorem for semi-simple algebras. It says that if you have a semi-simple algebra, then it is a direct product of endomorphism rings over a skew field, and that is sort of the thing which allows you to take products. And if you take a product of fields, you get a ring, and it's a ring which has a specific property, namely it's what's called semi-simple. And if you want to close up on even further, then you get the so-called separable algebras, which is probably the more intriguing category than just the semi-simple ones. But this just as a remark aside, I'm not going to prove or even elaborate on any of this. So, yeah, so how do we prove the theorem? Well, the lemma there showed that the two equivalent conditions A and B or A and B prime are the same. So the question is, can we, this is the first part, So if you are given any functor, f from I to C, and we want to calculate the inverse limit over f, of f over I. So this, the claim there is that you can always do it by just using products and pullbacks. Assuming that all the products and pullbacks exist. Well, let's see how it works. So remember, what is, let's assume this thing exists. So what is then hom C from Z to the inverse limit of F over I? Well, that was what we did at the very beginning today. These are sort of the families of morphisms alpha, such that all these triangles commute. So where A is in the objects of I, family alpha A from Z to FA, indexed by the objects of I, these are the data, and the requirement is that all these triangles commute. So for each F, F from A to B in I, star commutes. And now again, limits are easy because even though co-limits are just a dual version, but limits are usually easy because you can get the proof by just looking at the corresponding statement in set theory. So how can we write this? Well, I claim this thing here can be written as the product over all homomorphisms in C from Z to F of A. So what would this be? So this is just the family, alpha A indexed by A. Right? That's an element in here. And so I have a condition, and the conditions are that these triangles commute. Well, I'm going to write this as an equalizer. Product over all morphisms from A to B in I as hom C from Z, Z into F of B. And what are these two morphisms? So there are two of them. Let's call them phi and psi. And so I just want to, you see, what I want to say is that over the morphism F, so what do I do to my family? Well, the first thing, I just assign to it this component alpha B. So phi of alpha A at component F is going to be alpha of B, which is just alpha of the codomain or target of F. So I single out my first map, singles out this component. So remember, it's indexed by all the morphisms in I. The morphism phi singles out this one. And what does psi do? Well, psi, of course, just singles out this composition. So psi of alpha of the family component in F is going to be F of F composed with alpha of A. So psi is simply going to be this composition here. And clearly to say, so the family alpha AA makes the triangle for F from A to B commute if and only if phi of alpha, the component F, is equal to psi of alpha in the component F. Yeah? So I just encode in my two morphisms the fact that these triangles commute. But now you see, so this was just a remark, so if all products exist, well then I can rewrite this. I can first rewrite it as the equalizer, and I can put the product inside. Because remember our first example, we said these Hom sets is the same thing as the transformations of functors from the constant functor Z over the discrete category I to the family of objects F of A. So I can write this, assuming it exists, as Hom C Z inverse limit over I discrete of F restricted to I discrete. That's the first piece. And remember that certainly the discrete category is a subcategory of I. It just means I forget all the morphisms. So if I do that, I had a functor F on I. If I just forget what it does to the morphisms, I get a functor on the discrete category. And so this is a very fancy way of rewriting this piece here. And then I have these two maps, phi and psi, and I can do the same thing, except that here my indexing set is larger. The indexing set are all the morphisms in I. So I can write this as the homomorphisms over C from Z into the product over all morphisms in I, F of, and what's B for this morphism? It's just the target of the morphism. So either codomain or target. So it's a product over all morphisms of I, a codomain or target of F. And because this is, again, a set, and my assumption is that all products over sets exist, so this object exists. And now comes the Unet dilemma, which says, well, I can think of this as a transformation of representable functors by letting Z vary. So phi and psi are actually given . So this last equation uses that all products exist, which simply means that I can pull the product from the outside into the inside, and then this is equal to the equalizer. Well, first, I leave the equalizer outside. The same terms here. I'm only going to do something to the maps. I can write this as Hom C Z some phi hat. And I can write this as Hom C Z some psi hat into Hom C Z inverse product F in the morphisms of I F of, well, I should write it like this, codomain of F for some unique morphisms phi hat from the product here, so the product over all A and I F of A to product over all F in the morphisms of I f of the codomain of f, and this is, and similarly for psi, such that com c z phi hat equals phi, and similarly hom c z psi hat equals psi. This is Yonetas lemma. One of the sort of, this is a crucial kind of application. You have a transformation, you think of this as a transformation of functors, of pre-sheaves, because this holds for variable z. This means that these maps phi and psi come actually from morphisms between objects. And remember, we use that all products exist, so this thing here is an object in C, and so is this. And now, by definition of the equalizer, I can rewrite this whole thing as saying it's the homomorphisms over C from Z, the equalizer of phi hat and psi hat. Yeah, that means, again, I just sort of ignore all the Z's, then the equalizer is exactly what represents this on the level of sets. So this is here, if you like, by definition of the equalizer. So this means, in particular, that you need to know only one kind, or only two kinds of inverse limits: products, arbitrary products, and either at your whim, equalizers or fiber products. And fiber products are more commonly used, but there isn't really any reason to prefer one over the other. Okay, any questions on this? All right. So, now let me come back to an example which we did very early on. Remember, we took, believe, the finite groups, and we had the forgetful functor to sets. And we discovered that this functor is not representable, because there isn't sort of a unique finite group such that the morphisms from that thing to the finite group get us all the elements. That was contrary. If we look at all groups, remember, then the integers are the representing objects for the forgetful functor. However, we also discovered that if we allow, for example, all cyclic groups, so if we consider sort of this family of hom z mod nz into question mark, and we think of this functor as, so to say, a functor fn from finite groups to sets, then, well, what it does is for a group G, it singles out the set of G and G such that the order of G divides n. A homomorphism from the cyclic group of order n into any group G is nothing but an element whose nth power is the identity. And clearly, for any group G, if you assign to it the union over all n of fn of G, well, then we get G. Because in a finite group, every element has finite order. Now, the union, yeah, sees some wrinkled noses. So what does it mean, really, to make a union here? Well, the more precise way to write this would be you take the direct limit over n, well, let me write it like this, with respect to the multiplication, I come to, let me say it this way, you take the classifying category of the natural numbers with multiplication. Let's say natural numbers greater than 1. And you take the functor fn. So for each integer n, positive integer, you have a functor fn. Because the relations, of course, are if you have a map, say, from Z mod 6Z to F, or you have a map from Z mod 3Z to F, then, for example, each map, let's say pi 3, sorry, not from F, G, you can... you can from each map from a cyclic group of order 3 to G, you can of course fabricate a map from the order, group of order 6 to G by simply composing with a homomorphism from 6 to 3, right? Or similarly, if you have Z mod 2Z. So, and what this union here really is a direct limit over all these finite subsets of G. And so what it does is it recognizes that any element which has whose third power is trivial is definitely also an element whose sixth power is trivial. But now, the point I want to make is that we have this limit, direct limit of n over this sort of category of the natural numbers with respect to division of fn of g, which is the same thing as, the direct limit over n where Bn of Hom in finite groups from Z mod nZ to G. And this is very special, it's normally false. Here you can pull the limit inside. But what I want to say is you can construct the inverse limit of these finite groups and consider all the homomorphisms to G, and that will give reconstruct G. However, what is the inverse limit of these finite groups? That's no longer a finite group. This is what's called a profinite group. So, if you want the definition, I need here and sort of I give it to you in the correct way, even though it looks a bit bizarre. So if C is any category, then the profinite category, profinite completion, I should say, profinite completion of C is the full subcategory of of all pre-sheaves, C hat. Remember, these were the functors from C op to sets of the form inverse limit over I f for f from I to C, the functor on a small category. So in other words, we're just singling out all the pre-sheaves that are of the form inverse limit of something. And so if you take the profinite completion, so profinite, of course, then you have to say a functor on a finite. No. What am I saying? Sorry. The pro objects over C are the objects of the full subcategory of this form. And so the pro objects over the category of finite groups are called profinite groups. And what does it mean? So if you forget about the jingle, the jargon here, when is the group G profinite? Well, mind you, that if I have a finite group and I take an inverse limit, so because the category of groups is complete, thus a profinite group in view of what we just proved can be realized as, say, fiber product of products of finite groups. This is, of course, not a very good definition, but equivalently, a group G, so a profinite group G is profinite if and only if it is the inverse limit over all homomorphisms G to H subjective for all homomorphism G to H to finite groups H. So these are the groups where they have lots of finite quotients, and the whole group is known once you know all its homomorphisms to finite groups. And sort of the very typical example is this one here. So the inverse limit over all finite cyclic groups. So how does that look like? That's a very interesting exercise. It's not even an exercise. You can spend a whole course on that. What does the inverse limit over all finite cyclic groups with respect to the divisibility relation look like? So here's the theorem. This is what's also called the completion of the integers, and this is the direct product over all p prime over all the p-adic integers. Now to see, to make sense out of this last statement more easily, it is perhaps helpful to say that the remark, if you consider, so if, let's say, finite groups index p in the category of all finite groups denotes the full subcategory of all finite p groups. So in other words, all groups such that each element has order power of p, then the inverse limit, so you look at the inverse limit of p to the over the cyclic p groups, this is isomorphic to the p-adic integers and pro-represents the forgetful functor. From this category to set finite groups, p groups to sets. So that's how p-adic integers arise naturally as sort of the thing, which allows you to, which is sort of the closest. Remember what I said about representability at the beginning for inverse limits. It is sort of the closest object that covers all these finite groups. So it still contains essentially all the information about these finite groups here. Of course, it's not finite, so it does not represent the forgetful functor per se, but if you think of it in terms of precis, then indeed it is becomes representable, and the representing object is a p-adic integer. All right. Now, the dual statement. Of course, this is mindless repetition in some sense, but formulate everything for prolimits. So what are the duals of the three examples we looked at? Well, you have co-products, co-fiber products, co-fiber or co-Cartesian, co-fiber products or co-products. Co-fiber, I think they're called co-fiber products. Co-Cartesian squares, co-equalizers, and similarly, you have co-complete categories, which are the categories that are closed under all co-limits. And it's really instructive because I took, of course, the sort of more natural case. But this theorem I wrote down here earlier. In other words, that the existence of all limits was equivalent to the existence of all co-products and all fiber products, I really encourage you to rewrite this proof for co-limits. All co-limits exist if and only if all co-products and co-fiber squares or co-equalizers exist. Now, what is the co-product in the category of sets? So in other words, I'm giving a family of sets, and I want their co-product. So what property should it have? Now, if you think about what we said about products, now co-products, it's just a dual notion. So what we are looking for is we are looking for some object, question mark, so that whenever we have morphisms to some fixed set, one for each index, that there exists, first of all, natural morphisms to this desired one, and then there is a unique morphism from the question mark to Z such that everything commutes. So which set will do that? So let's not be so abstract. Let's just say we want the product of two sets. I have a set here and a set here. I'm giving you two morphisms, F and G, to some third set Z. Which set has the property that there exists a unique morphism or map from this object to Z such that it somehow encodes both G and F in a unique way? Disjoint union, yes. So the co-product, which is also written by the dual symbol to the product, like this, is the disjoint union. Now what's the co-Cartesian square? So what should I think is, so I'm giving three sets, I'm given morphisms A and B to a third, to another set U, such that the outer diagram commutes. And I want a unique morphism from the co-product of X and Y over Z to U. What should that be? So how do you get this? Well, you take the disjoint union of X and Y, and then you identify the two points, any two points which are the image of the same object, same element from Z. So, in other words, and I should give this names as before, F and G. So the so X co-product Z and Y is a set, so is the disjoint union of X and Y. So this is for disjoint union modulo the equivalence relation that F of X, F of Z is equivalent to G of Z. So I collapse, identify points which are the image of the same for some Z and Z. Now what would be the co-equalizer? So in other words, I'm looking for some object H such that whenever I take a morphism from Y to U with AF equals AG, there should exist a unique map here. And try to remember, this is just a dual, or the dual notion where we said that equalizers and fiber products are essentially the same thing. You have to tweak it a little bit. But, so, we already said what is the co-product, so what should be the co-equalizer? What will be Z? Yeah. So it's Y modulo F of X equivalent G of X. So you take Y and you identify two points which are the image under F or G of something from X. Okay, so in the category of sets, this is still somewhat reasonable to imagine. Now how about groups? I have a group G and a group H. What is the direct product of G and H? Co-product. Co-product of G and H. Yeah, so this is something quite a bit larger, so it's also sometimes written as G star H, right? It's a free co-product of G and H. So what are the, how is this group built up? For those who have never seen this before, and there are probably some here. So what's a free product or co-product, really, of two groups? But it's called the free product sometimes. Yeah, so this is a huge thing which contains all the words of the form. Oh, boy. So it's G1, H1, G2, H2, GN, HN, where the GI R and G, the HI R and H. And of course, you have to say when two words are the same. For example, I mean, that you could write, you have the identity element in G, so you have E times H is the same as H times E is the same as H. Right. But so it's a big group, much larger. So what is, for example, my favorite one, what's the free product of the cyclic group of order 2 and cyclic order of group of order 3? It's a very well-known group. Every one of you knows it. Well, sort of. So you have two very small groups. You take the free product. How does it look like? Anyone knows? Theorem. This is isomorphic to the group of all 2x2 invertible matrices with integral entries. Determinant 1 divided by its center. And the center is just given by plus minus the identity. So it's plus minus the identity. So you could write it like this. So it's a quotient modulo this subgroup plus minus 1, 0, 0, 1. Which is also called PSO2C, the projective special linear group of integer coefficients. Huge group. But what are the two generate? How do you get it? So, I mean, this group here, you see in this description, there's one generator here and a generator here. So this theorem says that every matrix up to sign can be written in the sense, as a word, in this matrix of order 2, in this matrix of order 3. Famous result in number theory and lattice geometry. So, quite different from the product, right? This here is much larger than the product, Z2 cross Z3. Now, how about abelian groups? If I were to do the same in the abelian group, after all, Z2 and Z3 are abelian groups. So if G and H are abelian groups, what's the co-product there? Or it's just the same as a direct product. What's the reason? Well, if you look at this description here, you see we have to, by definition of the co-product, we have to be able to extend whatever we do on G and H to something on this new group. And it's clear if I take all these words, if I have a morphism F on G and a morphism G on H, then, well, it's clear how to map these words, right? Whatever was defined on G, you apply to the Gs. Whatever was defined on the H, you apply to the Hs. And you're not allowed to introduce any cancellation unless for something trivial like this, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to freely extend any morphism on G and any morphism on H to this. However, if you are in the abelian case, then all these things commute. So you can pull all the Gs to one side and all the Hs to the other side. So there is no reason to build long words. It's just a set of pairs, G, H, with G and G, H and H. And you can do to each of the factors whatever you want without the other one noticing. So here, and this is of course the same as the product of G and H. So here we have the crucial property that both the co-product and the product exist and they are the same. Now, maybe just to confuse you a bit more, let's say I'll take two rings. Does a co-product exist, and what is it? Well, again, what kind of property does this ring have to have? It has to have the property that if I give any homomorphism F, ring homomorphism F from R to T, and any ring homomorphism G from S to T, then I can find a unique morphism on this new gadget. Well, clearly, because we don't assume anything on our rings, the basic construction is the same as here. We'll take all the words where the elements come from one factor or the other. However, that's not good enough anymore. Why not? We're not done yet. Huh? You want this to be a ring, not just something where you can multiply. So you have to extend by linearity. So in this ring, this will be all formal linear combinations of the type RI1, SI2, J1, RI2, SJ2, ba-ba-bum, RIN, SJN, so over all sorts of tuples IJ, finite sums, and of course the N can vary. And then you have some obvious identifications when two such sums should be represent the same element. For example, if you switch one of them, take one such word and you take the other word where you replace one of them by minus the element, then the sum is of course zero. So this is the free product or co-product of rings. What happens if I do this in the category of commutative rings? So think again. For commutative rings, as in the case of groups, things become much simpler because I can move all the R's to one side, all the S's to the other side. So what will be the co-product in the category of commutative rings? So if R and S are commutative rings, does it exist and what is it? So in other words, we just need to make precise or describe more precisely what we get. So we would like to say intuitively, this is sort of the summation of all pairs RISI, so finite sums with the RI and R, SI and S. But of course, there are some identifications. For example, clearly, if I take 2R times S, this should be the same as R times 2S. Right? Because after all, both of them would be equal to RS plus RS. So how does one call this ring? All such linear combinations of pairs of products, form a product, modulo these relations. Of course, you can do it for any n, right? Not just 2. 2 is just the example. More precisely, you have to have that R1S plus R2S equals R1 plus R2 times S, and the same on the other side. So R times S1 plus S2 equals RS1 plus RS2. So these are the real conditions you want for any R1, R2, etc. So how do we call such a ring? This is just the tensor product of the two rings over the integers. Tensor ring of R and S over Z. So that's how this occurs. It represents the co-product in the category of commutative rings. Okay. Now, in preparation for next time, here's a lemma. Assume both co-product and product of a family X alpha, X A, let's say A and I, exist in C, and C has a zero object. Then there exists a natural comparison morphism from the direct product to a direct co-product to the co-product to the product. Call it sigma. What is natural about it? Well, we can say it like this. So you see, what does it mean that we have a co-product? Well, this means it comes equipped with morphisms from each of the individual objects, such that whenever you give yourself a family of morphisms from XA to something, there is a unique one here. Well, what's the product? Well, this comes equipped with the projections. And the characterizing property is, if I have some object such that I give from this object morphisms into each of these individual ones, I get a unique one into the product. So what is this morphism sigma? Well, what we would like to say, this is a unique one which makes all these diagrams commutative. So sigma has a property that sigma composed with the inclusion at A followed by the projection on A is the identity on XA for each A. So how do we prove that something like this exists? Well, let's simply look at all morphisms from here to here. So what is HOM? And to make it clearer, I'll just take two different I take one co-product here, let's say B and J over YBs, and here I take a product over all A and I, XA. Now you unravel the definition of what these things represent, and I claim that this is the same thing as a product over A and I, product over B and J, HOM over C, from YB XA. So this holds in any category. And if I say that, this means, of course, you have these objects have to exist, and you have to be able to write it down, right? And so what is this thing here? Well, if I apply it to this situation, then what I get is I get, so for I equals J, XA equals YA, so then this last thing here becomes a product over all pairs, A comma B, in I cross I, HOM, C, XB, XA. And so how do I get this morphism sigma? Well, on the diagonal, that is where B equals A, I simply take the identity because this is what I want. But then I have to have some way of filling in the other components, right? What is off the diagonal. And usually there will be no preferred component outside the diagonal. But I certainly have one under the assumption that I have a zero object. So then sigma is the element in here such that sigma at component with indices A comma A is equal to the identity on XA, sigma on AB with A different from B would be just a zero map morphism. I don't have to specify this any further because there's only one such thing between any two objects. So, now let's look at this again in our examples. For example, in the category of sets, we said, so we'll just take two sets, X and Y. So we have the co-product of X and Y, we have the product of X and Y. Well, this example has one flaw, right? No zero. So what we better take is we take sets with base point. So the question is, what will be the co-product in the category of base points, of sets with base points? Now we said in the category of sets per se, forget about base points, the co-product is just the disjoint union. What should it be now? Right, it's a disjoint union. Identify the two base points. So the base point in X is set equal to the base point in Y. What's the product? It's just the product with the base point of the pair base point on X, base point on Y. What's the map sigma? Yeah. So here's your point. Here's your set X with its base point. Here's your set Y with its base point. The co-product is a union with the two base points identified. And the Cartesian product is a whole plane. So this is just the inclusion of the coordinate axes into the plane. Or, more fancy, an element of the form X in here goes to X, comma, the base point on Y, and an element Y goes to base point on X, comma, Y. And that's well defined because the two base points in X and Y have been identified. All right. Here's a much nicer. Remember the example I gave you just a second ago? We took Z2, free, or co-product with Z3, and I told you this is PSL2 integers, and we can map it into the product. Because after all, the category of groups or abelian groups does have a zero object. So this here is just Z mod 6. So there must be a canonical map from this group to Z mod 6. What is that group? It's Z morphism. That I give you as homework. Describe sigma in terms of matrices. Not obvious at all that there is a morphism here, not to mention one which has this kind of universal property. Okay. Now, just give you some food for thought while you go home. Two definitions. Because now we have sort of everything assembled we need to do some linear algebra. So a category A is additive if A, it is pre-additive. Remember what that meant? That meant essentially that every Hom set carries naturally the structure of an abelian group such that the composition is bilinear. And B, there is a zero object. C, product and co-product of any two objects exist. D, sigma is an isomorphism. For any x, y in A. So i.e., the natural map from the co-product from x and y to the product of x and y is an isomorphism. So these are the four properties an additive category has to satisfy. Second part, the category A is abelian if it is additive and any morphism has an analysis. Remember what that meant? That meant that every morphism can be decomposed in essentially a unique way as an epimorphism followed by a monomorphism. So you have an image factorization. So these are often also called add 0 through 3 or add 1 through 4. And then this is, so the additional property is then, as we will see next time, is equivalent to saying that the first isomorphism theorem holds, that you know from modules, abelian groups, and so on. Okay? Thank you very much.